wouldn't apply heat to a volumetric flask. That's what a boiling flask is for. Did you learn nothing from my chemistry class?
No. You flunked me. Remember?
No wonder.
That's Walter White, chemistry teacher, meth maker, and anti-hero of TV's Breaking Bad. Sounds like he knows what he's talking about, huh? We'll talk to a real-life chemist who makes sure of it. Then our annual bird show. First, to the mountains of Mexico. Flora Lichtman tells us the story of a bird enthusiast who risks his life to find a rare woodpecker. Then why are sounds like this one, or this one, music to some birder's ears? Some answers in your questions after this break. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you haven't seen the TV show Breaking Bad, get it on your Netflix queue, because at the center of the action is Walter White. He's the show's chemistry teacher turned meth maker turned anti-hero. This month, the Associated Press, Entertainment Weekly, even NPR's Fresh Air named the show as one of the top 10 TV shows of 2011. The show's fourth season just ended, and if you haven't seen it, you'll have a couple of months to catch up before the last season, season 5, gets started. And if you have seen the show, you know a bit about science. You've probably been pleasantly surprised about how accurate the science is. Well, that is no accident. Joining me now to talk more about it is the show's science advisor, Donna Nelson, in her day job as a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. She joins us from there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
How did you get such a good job like that?
Oh, it's just been amazingly fun. I'm a member of the American Chemical Society, and in its magazine, The Chemical and Engineering News, there was an interview of Vince Gilligan when he had first started the television show Breaking Bad. And in that interview, he was stating how important it was to him that he get the science right for the show. But he talked about how he didn't have that much of a science background, and none of his writers had an extensive science background, and so they were having to go to the web and Wikipedia in order to get science content. And he made a statement in that article that he would welcome constructive criticism from knowledgeable sources. And in looking at that, I realized it was organic chemistry, and I've been here. This is all I've ever done is teach organic chemistry, and I thought, I can do that.
You can do
so
that.
I volunteered.
That's great. Let's play a clip from the show so people get a little bit of flavor, if they haven't seen Breaking Bad, about what's happening there. So let me cue that up now.
Monoalkenes, diolefins, trienes, polyenes. I mean, the nomenclature alone is enough to make your head spin. But when you start to feel overwhelmed, and you will, just keep in mind that one element, carbon. Carbon is at the center of it all. There is no life without carbon.
Now that is the teacher, the character Walter White played by?
Yes, by Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston. And that is sort of a tame part of the program where he's actually teaching chemistry to the class there, right?
Yes, that was one of the scenes in which he was actually teaching organic chemistry to the high schoolers. And that scene is very interesting, at least to me, because they appealed to me and said, you know, we want to present him teaching about alkenes to these high school students. What would be appropriate for him to say? And they had written a few things, and there were, you know, some errors. And I mean, that's, you know, really basic organic chemistry. And so I just wrote them back a little bit about the nomenclature of alkenes, and you know, tried to fill them in a little bit. And a lot of what I said was used in that very introduction. It was really amusing to see them, you know, use the material. And at the end of that, they had said, well, is there anything that he would have written on the blackboard? And so I drew out some structures and sent them to him by email. And I was just amazed. They drew up on the blackboard exactly what I had sent them.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a chemistry teacher who finds out that he can make a lot more money making methamphetamines using his chemistry knowledge than he can teaching school.
Yes, so he's a very good organic chemistry and organic chemist. He's an excellent organic chemist, and so he makes excellent meth. And I'm always very fast to say that that is not what we do in our labs at the University of Oklahoma.
Does he ever,
or in any of our classrooms.
Are you ever fearful that he'll give away the recipe, the real way? Does he ever give away the real way to chemically make meth in a lab on the show?
Oh, do they do that?
Yes.
Are you asking
that?
Yes. No, they don't. That was actually one of the concerns of a lot of people, but... Vince Gilligan has been very clever. You know, there are multiple ways to make meth, and so although his scenes are very accurate, he will sort of kludge together parts of different syntheses, so that if you just simply followed the one synthesis as it's presented, you wouldn't come out with methamphetamine.
Yeah, I've got another cut I want to play here that sort of gives a little bit more of the flavor of the show on the darker side.
Okay.
They use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo?
No pseudo.
So you do have a plan. Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, science.
That's what one of his drug dealers telling him that he's very happy to know science because it's making him a lot of money.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's a very unusual show. And when this first... came about, and I had to decide whether I wanted to, you know, try to assist them. Originally, I was thinking, well, you know, would I want to get involved in something like this? And then after watching a few episodes of the show, I realized this is not glorifying drug making at all, because he has a very hard life, you know. I mean, starting out, he was in his underwear in the desert and, you know, the sand and getting scraped up, and then later he gets, you know, beat up and shot at and all sorts of fights. And I can't imagine somebody looking at that and saying, yes, that's exactly the type of life I want to lead. So I thought, well, you know, they're going to either have a hit show with good science portrayed or with bad science portrayed. And, of course, for scientists, when we see science portrayed badly, you know, inaccurately on television or in the movies, it's like fingernails on the blackboard. So I thought, well, you know, I'll help them. And, of course, I can't help them on the illicit meth scenes, the illicit meth lab scenes, but they get assistance from the DEA.
Yeah.
I'm not their only science advisor. They have many advisors, and I think I might have been the only one on the high school chemistry scenes, but they have many DEA agents helping them.
Let's go to a call from Mitchell in Chicago. Hi, Mitch. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. I love Science Friday.
Thank you. Got a question for us?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to say I've always been interested in chemistry ever since I was little, but when I started watching this show, I decided to go back to college to study chemistry.
Wow, so that was an impetus, a catalyst, as they would say in chemistry.
Yeah, catalyst.
That's actually wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I think that Vince Gilligan would be thrilled to know that his show is having that sort of an influence.
Thanks.
Yep, I can't wait for the next season. It's not coming soon enough.
That's the last one.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Is he really concerned? The producer is he really concerned about, you know, encouraging people to learn about chemistry on each episode? Does he have a little bit of real chemistry on it, or has that sort of gone away?
I think so. Yes, he really does, and he was very concerned about getting the science right. He was. I was really delighted to see this in him because, you know, for so long there's been this sort of a myth that you can't portray good science or accurate science and actually have an interesting show. And I think that this show proves that that is a myth. It is entirely possible to present science accurately and have a hit show. And I really hope that what he's done, and of course this has been done by other television shows, you know, CSI, etc.
Big Bang Theory.
But I hope that it will inspire others to follow his example.
So you must be sad to see it going into its last season then.
Yes, you know, it's been a wonderful show, but I really do believe that others will pick up where he's left off in this one aspect.
Do you believe that science is having sort of a rebirth on in the entertainment industry, on television, perhaps in the movies, with science movies and TV shows coming out?
Yeah, I think it perhaps is. I know that many of the scientists are trying to become more available now as science advisors, and the National Science Foundation is really trying hard to further this. And, you know, there have been even discussions in Congress about what we need is a hit television show that portrays good science. And that's been said for a long time. And, of course, like I mentioned, there are many shows that already fill that, such as CSI. But this is the first time that we've had one, I believe, on organic chemistry per se.
I would have never thunk it myself, having done so terribly in chemistry in my own lifetime, that a kid show would have been based around organic chemistry.
Yeah. Well, I say that, you know, it's a lifetime goal trying to teach organic chemistry to make it easy. And I'm starting to wonder if I'm ever going to achieve it in my lifetime.
His teaching,
but we do try.
Do you use the same teaching methods that he does in the front of that classroom?
No, not really. Of course, I'm teaching at the graduate level, and,
right.
and the chemistry that I'm teaching is more difficult. I'm teaching undergraduate and graduate both, but it's a little more advanced than what he gets into. His is really sort of a lower level, and when you get more to the higher levels, you have to teach more pattern recognition. It can't possibly be just straight memorization. I think the key to making it easier is the pattern recognition and, you know, relating just simple rules,
right.
To be able to absorb the mass amount of material and draw patterns across the material. That's what will make it easier.
And what makes this show interesting to viewers, I guess, is that it deals with the drug world, which a lot of people know a lot about, but it uses that as, so to speak, the catalyst to talk about the science itself.
Because yeah, I think that much of the science is so spectacular that, to me, it seemed to almost become a separate character in the show. And when I mentioned that to Vince, he said yes, that he thought that was the case. And so I don't know if he actually intended that from the beginning, but that's the way it's worked out, and I think it's wonderful.
So people would expect, like, a character to show up every week, right? You tune in to see what he might be talking about, what the science might be in that episode.
Yeah, a different type of science or a different little take on science or, you know, something interesting about science.
Yeah, just
I think it's been wonderful. It was just so much fun participating in this. I had a terrific time, and I would strongly recommend other scientists who are considering doing this to go ahead. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. And do you know what happens in the fifth season yet?
No, I don't. And even if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Just between us. Thank you. And good luck to you. And maybe we'll see you on another TV series soon. Never know.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I would love it. It's been a terrific amount of fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Donna Nelson, in her day job, is a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and she joined us from Norman. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the annual Christmas bird count and all kinds of stuff having to do with birds. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, Ira Flatow here, wishing you only the best in this holiday season and hoping you might think about putting Science Friday on your gift list. You can make a tax-deductible donation. Any amount will do. Please just go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the Support Science Friday button at the top. Thanks and happy holidays. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Birding. Birding doesn't seem like a risky pastime, does it? What's the worst that could happen? Sunburn, a little rain, a little cold, lost binoculars? Well, not always. In 2010, Tim Gallagher, editor of Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Living Bird magazine, went in search of a rare woodpecker and was lucky to make it back alive. Our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman, talked to Gallagher about it and has this story.
The imperial woodpecker is 2 feet tall. That's huge.
As far as we've been able to determine from the fossil record, there's never been a bigger woodpecker.
Its closest relation is the ivory-billed woodpecker, and like its cousin, the imperial is critically endangered, if not extinct. The last credible sightings were in the 90s, but Tim Gallagher thought that there's a chance a few still may exist, which is what drew him to the remote mountain range in Mexico where the woodpecker lives.
The Sierra Madre's always been a rugged, ungovernable place.
And that's where the story turns. An ordinary birding expedition, this was not.
It's heavy drug-growing country, holding AK-47s. The guy was trembling and all white as a sheet.
It just got crazier and crazier. It's like unbelievable.
That's basically how the story ends. But it really begins 50 years ago with the late William Ryan.
William Ryan was a dentist who lived in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he was also an amateur ornithologist. He was basically a bird fanatic, and he was really obsessed with the imperial woodpecker.
Tim Gallagher, by the way, is also really obsessed with the imperial woodpecker.
They're just so huge and powerful, swift flying, and their crests. I just get real pleasure from seeing them.
Ryan must have felt similarly. Back in the 50s, he made several self-funded trips to the mountains of Mexico to look for this bird, and he's the only one known to have captured the bird on film. But for many years, he kept the footage kind of under wraps.
The only opportunity he had to film this bird, he was on the back of a mule, so it was kind of jerky. So I think he was embarrassed by it, and he never really told many people about it.
Until an ornithologist by the name of Mark John Lammertink found a reference to the footage in some old letters and tracked Ryan down.
So he went there not knowing if this would be any good. He thought, at best, maybe there'll be an identifiable image of this bird, which will be nice.
When he got to the house, Ryan loads the reel on his 16-millimeter projector.
You're all set to go. Press your fingers. And I haven't looked at this for years and years and years.
That was recorded. That's when Mark John first saw that film. He turned his tape recorder on when the guy was playing it. And
right here now is where this is the ivory-billed country right here.
They started rolling this film. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, this bird's hitching up the tree. And
yeah, now this is back in the woods.
There it is. You see it?
Yeah, there it is, yeah.
Chipping off chunks of bark, throwing pieces of bark away with its bill. And
incredible.
It even takes off and flies three different times. And so in an 85-second film, it's just an incredible amount of stuff going on.
Wow.
Well, I thought that was lousy, but I had forgotten about those shots.
It was just such a tangible thing, something you could almost reach out and touch, you know. It was just like seeing a ghost. Watching that movie in many ways inspired me. I just want to go there and save that bird.
And that's what they tried to do. Gallagher and the ornithologist Lammertink got together an expedition to go to the Sierra Madre Occidental, to the exact same spot where that footage was shot 50 years ago.
Marchand knew a forester in the city of Durango in Mexico, which is about a five-hour drive from where we were going to go in the mountains, and he was real familiar with that area. It's heavy drug-growing country, opium and marijuana, which we didn't fully realize when we first went up there. Before we'd gone a couple of months earlier, communicating with the forester, he said, it's still pretty safe in this part of Mexico, so you should be okay. But when we finally got down there, he said, you know, there's really like a wave of violence starting to sweep through here. And actually, we had some pretty scary things happen right from the start.
Like, for instance, the night before they were supposed to leave Durango,
we got a call from the forester, and he said he'd received an anonymous call from someone who knew exactly what we were doing and when we were going and was really furious about it. In fact, one of the Mexican scientists who was going to go with us, he dropped out of the expedition at that point. And so suddenly it was like, should we not go, or what's happening? You know, we were so close. It was like our excitement level was so high. I knew if we left, no one would go to check that area in our lifetimes. And I just thought, we got to go. And we decided we were going to go. But we had our first bad encounter the next day as we were driving up there. This dark truck came up behind us, and then came racing by, and all the guys in it were holding AK-47s. And they matched the description of some people who murdered someone in another village about a week ago. By the time we left, it felt more like the mountains of Afghanistan than Mexico. And, you know, three houses were burned and a man was abducted by, you know, from a little village. And all the villagers had to put their money together to buy this guy back. And it's just insane. You know, I mean, what are they going to do the next time someone gets grabbed?
How did you guys stay safe? What was your strategy?
We didn't really have a strategy. We just tried not to bother anyone and went with our business.
Which, remember, started out at least as a mission to find a woodpecker. So that's what they tried to do. And one of their tricks was this.
We play these recordings of an ivory-billed woodpecker because their voice is supposed to be just like an ivory bill. It sounds like a loud toot of a child's toy horn.
They were hoping for a toot in return.
Rumors still do come out of there of, you know, lone imperial woodpeckers. But in all the places we went, we didn't get any response.
They never did spot the bird on that trip. Gallagher says logging has destroyed much of the imperial's habitat. And he heard from people who live there that 50 years ago there were extermination campaigns by loggers who thought the birds threatened the timber. Since then, new threats have emerged.
I'll tell you one of the worst moments for me. We were warned against crossing the Rio Taxacaringa. And on the other side, the CETAS controlled it, which is one of the worst drug cartels. And one day we're on the top of this cliff looking across the canyon, and there were people out there burning these old-growth trees. And they were going to destroy that forest so they could, you know, plant more opium poppies. And there was nothing we could do about it. It wouldn't have mattered if there were imperial woodpeckers over there. I'm almost glad I didn't see one because it would have just made me sick. You wouldn't know what to do. The Mexican government can't go up there. It's too dangerous, you know. And I'm a real optimistic person about just about everything I do, and it just became so depressing. You know, at the end, we really did not know if we were going to get out of there. I even took the memory cards out of my cameras and my voice recorders and things, and I put them in the little hip pocket on my jeans just in case, you know, we got robbed or murdered. At least what I'd gotten would exist, you know.
What started out as a quest to save a bird became a trip about Gallagher's own survival.
Luckily, we made it out of there. But then the next day, we arranged to meet the forester in the city of Durango out in the park, and we were going to have breakfast together. And he walks up to us, and he's shaking. And he just hugs us both tightly. And he said, you know, if anything would have happened to you, I never would have forgiven myself. And he said that night before we drove out, he and his wife got down on their knees and, you know, prayed to God for our safety and everything. By that time, we were all just standing in that park crying, you know, but it was awful.
Gallagher isn't planning to go back anytime soon, he says, but he didn't know that right away. After all, he'd spent years researching this bird. He'd made half a dozen trips to Mexico in the last 2 years.
It was hard to back away from it. I was really, really interested in the work, and I loved interviewing the people. And I think about the bird. It's too dangerous. It's too, you know, I've got kids at home that I need to raise.
Which for Gallagher may mean being haunted indefinitely by a ghost bird 3,000 miles away. For Science Friday, I'm Flora Lichtman.
If you want to see the only documented footage of the imperial woodpecker, check out our video pic from a few weeks ago. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com. Every year, a group of people peer into the sky with binoculars while mimicking bird sounds on a cold winter day. No, it's not too much eggnog. They are volunteers for the annual Christmas bird count, now in its 112th year. These citizen scientists count birds across North America as they migrate south for the winter, and these bird enthusiasts are among the first to spot a bird like this Rufus hummingbird. Spotting it far from its natural habitat, they also keep a watchful eye on endangered species, like this great sage grouse. You knew what that was. The data they collect is vital for bird conservation. But before these bird lovers can count the whooping cranes, the prairie warblers, and even the wood ducks, how do they identify them? My next guests know a thing or two about that. Dr. Gary Langham is chief scientist of the National Audubon Society, which manages the annual bird census. He joins us from our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Richard Crosley is a birder, photographer, and author of the new book, The Crosley ID Guide, Eastern Birds, which you can see all kinds of birds, every kind of bird from the east. And there, welcome to Science Friday, Richard.
Thank you, Ira.
Gary, how is the bird count going this year?
It's going well so far. We started, as usual, on December 14th, and it runs through January 5th. It's shaping up to be a pretty mild year in terms of weather. And, when people do these bird counts, they're usually hoping for a rare sighting. But they're also looking for these really cyclical events. And this year's winter seems to be snowy owl invasion.
Snowy owl invasion. What do you mean by that?
Well, apparently it was a bumper crop for lemmings in the Arctic this year. And so it was also a bumper crop for snowy owls. And in most years, that species should be very far to the north. But because there are more birds than there are food to feed them all, we're getting a whole bunch of really young birds moving very far south, as far south as Oklahoma, Kansas, and lots of sightings in the Great Lakes region so far.
Wow. Any other surprises popping up?
Well, every time people go out, they're always hoping to break their own personal record or have a high count for the circle or see a vagrant bird like the Rufus hummingbird you had at the top, which I gather was one in Central Park this year.
Sure, it shouldn't be there?
It shouldn't be there. It should be somewhere between Alaska and Mexico, closer to Mexico this time of year.
Wow. We're talking about the Christmas bird count on Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Gary Langham, and now Richard Crosley. I know before everybody bundles up and heads out for a bird count, you can prepare for it, and you're a proponent of reality birding. What does that mean? I know in your books, in the Crosley ID Guide, the birds are just not on stark white pages, but they're in their natural habitat. Is that what you mean by that?
Yes, it is. I mean, for to learn today, we want to make anything lifelike. Thankfully, because of digital technology and Photoshop, we can make things more lifelike. So I created images that were in focus from near to far. And if we look how the brain learns, how we teach kids and apply that to all the research that's been done, I think it's created something that's far more visual than the flat white background images of the past. And that's going to help people, or hopefully inspire people, to go out and look at birds more closely, be able to understand their world, relate to it better, and hopefully become better birders.
Mm-hmm. In your bird book, there's some gorgeous pictures of birds, but what role does sound play in identifying birds, like the snowy owl or that Rufus hummingbird?
Well, not so much in the role case of snowy owl. We very rarely hear them. But for sound plays in a massive part in birding. For, some people will say that 90% of birds are actually identified by sound before they're actually seen. It's a huge part.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking about the Christmas bird count. Let's go to the phones. Quick call before the break. Steve in North High Shoals, Georgia. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi there.
We were on a Christmas bird count on Tuesday, the Lake Oconee Christmas bird count, and there are three of us in our party, and Rachel looked out the window, and she's like, what's that bird with the green wing? And we looked up, and it was a green-tailed towhee, and it was only the second time the bird has been recorded in Georgia. The first one was 1953. So right now, every morning, people from all over Georgia have been going to that spot to see that bird.
Wow, Gary, what do you say about that?
Yeah, that's really one of the exciting things that gets people out braving the cold, is looking for those rarities. And it's exciting when people will come from all over to add to their list. On the other hand, the reason we all do it is to get trends for birds that are supposed to be there. So, you know, it's a real privilege to be part of something that's been going on for 112 years to help the conservation side too. So you have your fun social event with your friends in your neck of the woods, but also building this much larger database that's useful for conservation science.
Well, congratulations to you, Steve.
Thanks. And the only reason we'd ever be on that road was because it was a Christmas bird count. It's like in a farm area and really kind of in a cow pasture, basically. And so it got us out to an area where we normally wouldn't be birding. So that's what's another thing that's kind of interesting about Christmas bird count sometimes.
Well, good luck to you. Have a happy holiday.
Thanks. You too.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Richard, quickly, you have that bird in your book?
I do have that bird in the book, mate, yep. It's actually very, very rare from the west. I think there was a big drought in the middle of the country this year, so a lot of green-tailed towies, sage thrashers were displaced. They're not really wintering where they usually are, and a lot have moved further south and east than usual. So that's probably one of the reasons why it's been seen in Georgia.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about birding with Dr. Gary Lantham, who is a chief scientist of the National Audubon Society. Richard Crossley is a birder of the highest order. He's a photographer and author of the Crossley ID Guide, Eastern Birds Out. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Get your binoculars after this break. Hi, SciFry fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFry iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFry Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFry BE app. That's the SciFry BE app. Download and enjoy. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about birds this hour. It's our annual bird show where we talk about the Christmas bird count with my guest, Gary Lantham. He's chief scientist for the National Audubon Society. Richard Crossley is a birder, photographer, and author of the Crossley ID Guide, Eastern Birds. And he's got some great photos in there of birds all in the east. Do you have an addition for the other parts of the country, Richard?
Yeah, I'm doing a Western one. I'm actually doing a British and Irish one. That might surprise some people with my accent. we're also working on this concept of doing some other books on raptors, warblers, and another one on ducks as well. So the one for ducks is actually going to be for birders and hunters. So hopefully we can bring these two groups together because both do a lot for conservation. And that's one of my goals, is to get more people involved, see as one, and ultimately help with saving the great outdoors and birds.
Mm-hmm. And in that vein, we're going to have our first Science Friday bird sound quiz. Maybe we can make this an annual bird count event. We're going to play a sound, you know the thing, you guess the bird, and the first caller to get the right answer is actually going to win a copy of Richard Crossley's book, The Crossley ID Guide, Eastern Birds. So we're going to play the sound. I may play it a couple of times so you can hear. Here is that bird. Okay, that was the sound of our first contest. If you think you know the answer, 1-800-989-8255. I would like to say you could tweet it in, but we have no way of getting back to you on Twitter on this sort of thing. So we're just going to take phone calls this time. Maybe next year we'll have a little bit more of an idea how to work Twitter better. Neil, let's play the sound again so that people who might have heard it, now they can perk up. Okay, that was the mystery bird sound. I'm going to give you a hint to begin with. It's a shorebird that lives in the forest. So that's our first hint, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones and take some calls while they're guessing on that one. Let's go to John in Sacramento. Hi, John.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Hi there.
Hey, I just had a question for your guests. As far as a bird call, I would have no clue. But with them being doing this every year for so long, do they notice anything in the migratory patterns that they think might be contributable to global warming? I'd like to know their thoughts on that, and I can take the answer off the air.
Okay, John, thanks for calling. Gary, Richard?
Yeah, actually, yes. When I first came to Cape May to America, things were quite different. For example, willets didn't winter in our neck of the woods. Now there's hundreds of them winter here. And so there's several other species where clearly their birds are wintering further north. And the hummingbird, Rufus hummingbird that you just mentioned, it's also quite clear that different species of hummingbirds, every winter there's more and more of them sort of reaching further and further north. And basically what they're probably doing is just expanding their range further northwards, that are certainly their wintering range, because of the milder winters. There are other examples, but you know, but that's definitely the case. Yeah,
Gary, you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of species, you know, including things like black skimmer, that have been documented to be progressively moving north. But a few years ago, we also did an analysis based on 40 years of Christmas bird count data, in addition to breeding bird survey data, to show that the birds have really spoken on this topic with their wings. They, if you look at where their centers of range abundance are. We looked at 305 species. They had moved, 58% of them had moved around 100 miles north, their center of their range. And we're doing a different kind of analysis right now. We're right in the middle of it for 600 species in North America, based on these same counts that everyone goes out, they have a good time, they collect data, to understand the relationship between where birds occur and climate so that we can project forward under all future climates in 2020, 2050, and 2080.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Deborah in Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Deborah. You got a guess?
I do. I wasn't positive about it. It's just a wild guess, but I wanted to find my bird book before you got to me, but oh, darn. But I was thinking a booby.
Oh, I wish Flora were here with her sound effects. No, it's...
I think the guy who took my call didn't believe. He thought I was being funny, and I'm like, no, that's the kind of bird. isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'll ask the bird experts. Gary,
but
Richard?
I'm a bird fanatic, and I have to say we have a dead tree in the backyard, a dead Schwedler maple. It's been the home to... Birds just love it, and I'm telling you, they just like... It's a perfect setting. We're north of a big park, and we have such a wide variety of birds in our yard. But the birds, like woodpeckers, four woodpeckers are born in this tree, and the babies come back, and they're carving this tree to shreds. It's just amazing and fun to look at.
Wow, sounds great. Well, you didn't get it right, but it's a great call. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Have a happy holiday. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to a second guest in Jesse from Linnsville, North Carolina. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how are you, Ira?
You got a guess for us?
I was going to guess black crowned night heron.
No.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. We're going to just go down.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm just going to go down the phone list here, and just in the order that they're coming in. Let's go to Mary in Richmond. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you? You got a guess?
Yeah, American woodcock.
Bingo.
Yeah.
You said it. All right. You rang the bell. The American woodcock. How did you know that?
Because I'm a birder, and I actually work for National Audubon Society.
I should have disqualified you.
That's not fair. You didn't say that in the beginning.
No, that's true. Okay. Let's listen to the sound again, just so that Pete, now we'll know what to listen for the American woodcock. You can hear those frogs chirping in the background. That's terrific. All right, Mary, stay on the line because I'm going to put you on hold. Someone's going to take your phone, your address, so we can send you the new book, the Crosley ID Guide.
I'm so excited. Thank you.
Okay, hang on. Don't go anyway. All right, here we go. I got her on hold there. Tell us about that bird. Tell us about the woodcock, Richard. What is it?
As you mentioned, it's a shorebird that lives in the woods, usually in deep forests. It's a fat thing with quite a long, stout bill. It has wacky eyes that's on the side of the head, so it looks backwards as much as it looks forward. I guess it really looks sideways. And it makes that noise in the spring. Let's call it pinting. And you can often see it right at dusk. It's crepuscular. It comes out, in the twilight. And in spring, you can see it often flying, eroding over the woods and as it's displaying. And otherwise, it's a bit of a pain in the neck to see, actually. It runs around in the floor, and its colours are camouflaged, so it just blends in with the leaves. And when you go near it, it just freezes and until you get too close, and then it just flushes and flies off, not to be seen again.
What was your most challenging photo to take in the book?
Well, you must know your stuff, Ira, because that was actually the one. That was it. Trying to get that at night or at dusk in flight was the hardest one, other than the ones that I didn't get, of course. But it took me probably 5-6 full days time-wise, but maybe about 30 attempts before I finally got it.
My
wife wasn't happy. Dinners.
Are all birders this, intense at what they do?
No, but I think it's like many sports. If you start as a kid like I did, I started when I was 7, it becomes an obsession. It's certainly not a hobby. It's debatable whether it's even a sport. It's more like life. So a number do become totally obsessed, like you would guess I am,
Yeah, Yeah, I understand it. Gary, is it too late to get in on this year's Audubon Society Bird Count?
Oh, and the Christmas Bird Count? No,
yes.
I mean, you can go to the Audubon website and find where a circle and a count that's upcoming is still to happen. In some cases, they're already full because there's a compiler in charge of each of the 2,200, and they spend a lot of time and effort making sure that they're being well covered. But people can still get involved. And it's not the only thing that people can do that's socially fun and for conservation. There are lots of things throughout the year. So if people can't get involved this year, they don't need to wait till next Christmas Bird Count. They could do the Great Backyard Bird Count in February over President's Day weekend, mm-hmm. or enter stuff into eBird. There's lots of ways to get involved. Go to an Audubon chapter. Just get involved in your community. That's the main message.
Can you stay in your backyard and just tell you or people interested in what comes to your bird feeder?
Yeah, a few years back, we made it possible for people to just watch from their feeders. So if the only trick is that the place where they're watching has to be within the count circle for a Christmas bird count. For a Great Backyard Bird Count in February, you could just be anywhere.
1-800-999-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Lori in Gladstone, Michigan. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm listening to your show while driving back up north to northern Michigan after doing some visiting in southern Michigan for the holidays. On the way back, I stopped at a landfill to chase a rare gull that's been sighted there. I think that's pretty typical for birders to do odd things like that.
Well, I was going to interrupt you and say, what do you mean? You get out of your car and you do chase this bird. So where did
well
into the landfill?
Meaning, I'm driving out of my way to hope to see this bird that has been reported.
Uh-huh.
But
did you get a picture of it at all?
I'm sorry.
Did you get us a picture or something?
I did take some pictures, and I'm actually going to have to review that to be sure that it's the bird I think it is. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not positive, but it has been sighted by others.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
My question was, it just seems like there's more and more of these very odd of way, out of their range birds that we seem to be hearing about. And I'm wondering, my question for your guests is, do these odd sightings seem to be increasing?
Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Gary Langham and Richard Crosley, author of the Crosley ID Guide, Eastern Birds. Gary, Richard, are we seeing more rare birds around?
Yes, but I think only because our knowledge is getting better, so we know what to look for a little more. I don't think the reality is any different. I think the other thing, your caller said, you're in a bird is like this, we're going to landfills. I think one of my points would be that we need to get away from creating the image of bird as being a little wacky and eccentric. I mean, I think birding, and this was really the point of the book, birding should be for the masses. I mean, I think we all want to love the outdoors. It's fantastic to be outdoors. Birds are around us everywhere, whether it be in suburbs, cities. And so it's just about being out, enjoying the birds, not necessarily putting a name to them, but just relating to them, being aware of the environment around us, and understanding birds, not trying to put a name to them, but learning the bird, how they live, what they do, when do they occur in their garden, watch how birds come through our gardens, different birds at different times of year, and just become more aware of our environment so we relate to it better, enjoy it more. And so really that was the purpose of my book, to help people look at things a little differently because of the knock-on for conservation as well as lifestyles.
You know, I found one interesting remark you made in your book that I think we're all guilty of, certainly I, who like to look at birds, is you say we look too much at the color of the birds. I mean, and that's what we're all looking at, isn't it?
But it shouldn't be. If we describe people, you might describe me as a white guy. Well, maybe my derriere is white, but the rest of me is pale brown, and my face is brown, and I've had a couple of drinks, it gets red, and my clothes change every day. Well, birds are much the same. The colours are always changing, but the size, the shape, the behaviour, where they live, what they do, just like in people, always stay the same. So the best birders, that's how we look at birds. But not only that, but it's more interesting. As people, we're interested in people's lifestyles, what they do, how they behave. And it's the same with birds. I think birds are more fascinating because of, how they live, what they do. And I think once people start looking at birds on that level, rather than just on the level of colour, they become much more engaged and fascinated by them, which, again, with all the knock-ons of, getting people doing it more often and conservation, I just think is where we need to be, going, and we need to de-emphasise colour and just make it more about enjoying birds and environment. And that's really the purpose of the book. That's why the plates are made into lifelike scenes, so you can just enjoy the beauty of it. And research shows that anything that's more entertaining, anything that's more lifelike and reflects reality, people are going to understand it and relate to it a lot better. Mm-hmm. So that's the purpose of the book.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in. Last call from Don in Bristol, Tennessee. Hi, Don.
Hi, guys. My question is for Gary, and Gary, I've participated in two CBCs so far. I have one more to go in this upcoming weekend. But this year, for our CBCs, we had very low numbers of birds. We had great species, but low numbers. And it was just inactive days, is what we call them. The birds just weren't active. They were hard to find. We were beating the path, but we just wasn't finding them. And my question to you is, when you receive the data, do you have a way to account for that?
All right. Let me get a quick answer because we're running out of time. Good question.
Okay. Well, I think it's a really interesting observation and some things that were being reported in other counts that have happened so far. And at the moment, we think it probably has to do with the mild nature of this winter season so far. So the so-called half-hardy birds may not have moved south yet. We haven't really had a lot of cold snaps. But Don, I think this really underscores the importance of doing this not just one year at a time, but year over year, so that you can really do the good science to understand the real trends and differentiate between a weather event and real changes. But it's really interesting.
I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Dr. Gary Langham is chief scientist for the National Audubon Society. Richard Crosley is birder, photographer, and author of the Crosley ID Guide, Eastern Birds. Thank you for joining us today. Great.
Thank you.
Have a happy holiday. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alicia Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.